Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good morning. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is attorney Bob Loeb, co-author with I. Nelson Rose on the classic book, Blackjack and the Law. We'll be talking to Mr. Loeb shortly. In the recent news, Penn National has bought the Tropicana Casino here on the Strip for some $360 million. I'm cautiously optimistic about this. Penn National operates the M Casino about 12 miles south of the Trop. The M is operated differently than any other Vegas local casino. It appears the Penn National team believes that what they learned running casinos elsewhere is the right way to do it in Las Vegas as well. We'll see how that philosophy translates to the Las Vegas Strip. Richard.
Yeah, well, hopefully the quality of the food will go up. But yeah, I'm also cautiously optimistic. So, I mean, from table games side, it's not there's not much at the Tropicana, and they sweat it pretty bad. So. It can only get better.
All right. We've been following the machine versus players in the 80,000 hand heads up no limit hold'em tournament at the Rivers Casino in Pittsburgh. Yesterday, with approximately 61,000 hands already played, the players were ahead by $680,000 and growing. Every time it looks, it gets bigger. Since this is all about me, it looks like I will lose $20 in wagers to Munchkin and Jeff Wong. Next week, we're going to have Ed Miller as a guest. Not only is he a poker expert, he has 2 degrees from MIT, so we'll ask him to speculate on why players beat this machine so handily, but limit hold'em has been solved, but apparently not no limit hold'em. Now, do any of you need a blackjack table or roulette wheel? Well, if so, Richard has good news for you.
Right. So the Riviera closed yesterday after 60 years, and they are going to be selling off the contents of the hotel and casino. So that is supposed to start on May 14th. The first 4 days, you have to pay $10 entry fee to get in. After that, if there's still anything left, I guess it'll be free. So, yeah, if you want to pick up a cheap blackjack table or actually roulette wheel, I'm in the market for a roulette wheel, but I'm going to be out of town that weekend. So if you want a link to the site that explains it all, it's on our Facebook page, facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge. Might want to go check it out.
All right. We've known for some time that the IRS is considering lowering the W-2G threshold from $1,200 to $600. That's still under discussion. Players and casinos are unanimously against this. This part is nothing new. The discussions, however, are much worse than we earlier believed. This week, the IRS and the American Gaming Association were in discussion concerning the feasibility of the slot clubs automatically sending all slot club records to the IRS, including annual win-loss statements. This would be huge. This would be terrible. Currently, a large part of the record keeping of your video poker and slot results is done on the honor system. While W2Gs are in black and white, most other numbers aren't. I have no idea how much slot winnings are underreported, but it's common, for example, to believe that if you don't get a W2G, you don't have to report anything. even if you did hit, say, $20,000 worth of W-2Gs in a day, whether your actual win was $20,000, $5,000, minus $5,000, or minus $20,000 is largely for each player to write down. Suffice it to say, with that kind of leeway, many players underreport winnings and overreport losses. Win-loss statements are notoriously inaccurate, but they are getting better. If you keep accurate records, sometimes you're going to find that you won $5,000 from a casino over the year, but the casino reports that you won $50,000. That happens. Although today it simply means the casino will kick you out for being too good. If they reported that information to the IRS, this would automatically give you $45,000 more taxable income that you never got. This will be disastrous to players and a boon for tax lawyers. Mr. Loeb may decide to change profession from gambling lawyer to tax lawyers. Now, these proposals are still in the talking stage right now, but should they pass, and they might, this will likely lead to many players refusing to play slots or video poker with a card. This will greatly change the dynamics of that game. Richard?
I agree. Their record keeping is a disaster. It would be bad. It also is going to be much more paperwork for the casinos. It's all around a bad idea. Currently, your diary is accepted above the casino's record keeping. So, currently your record is the record. And it'll be interesting to see if that were to change if they were to enact this. But on the other hand, if this did cause the majority of players to start playing without a card, well, that would be a good thing in my book. So
good thing for?
For players. For table game players, this would be a good thing if it became the norm for players to not want to use a player's card. To me, that would be a good thing, because then I wouldn't stand out as a table games player when I said I don't want to use a player's card. If that becomes the norm, for me, that's a good thing.
Okay, currently, for more than really low stakes, you cannot play video poker profitably unless you use a card. You need the points.
Many casinos now are restricting players that don't use a player's card on table games. So in some casinos, if you don't want to use a player's card, you're restricted to sometimes 10 times whatever the table minimum is your maximum. You're not allowed to play two hands. Various other restrictions that depend on the particular casino, but they're limiting what you can bet and how much you can play if you're not willing to give them a player's card.
From the casino's point of view, that seems easy to understand. From the player's point of view, that sucks.
Yeah, but even from the casino's point of view, I mean, in the old days, the casinos knew that a lot of the big money players got their money illegally, right? And they understood why a particular player would not want to give them any personal information. And they were fine with that because most of the time those big money players lose an incredible amount of money. So,
But of the people who don't want to give personal information today, how many of them got the money illegally versus how many are either advantage players or want to be advantage players?
I think the percentage of people who are an actual threat to a casino because they're advantage players is tiny, really tiny.
Percentage-wise, yes. Dollar-wise, maybe not so much.
Okay. I don't know.
We can debate that some other time. Let's talk to our guest. Bob Lowe has been described as the Bob Nersessian of the Midwest. He's based in Chicago and is primarily a defense attorney, and he frequently takes players as clients in gambling cases. Bob Lowe, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Good morning there, I guess. How are you guys?
We're good. Yeah, good. Here it is morning. It's Cinco de Mayo, so buenos dias, senor.
Buenos dias.
We're drinking margaritas here while we talk to you.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't have it any other way.
All right. Now, there's a situation not so long ago where some players were driving home to Las Vegas through northern Arizona after doing very well in Chicago area casinos. The players had something like $400,000 in cash on them, which was confiscated by the police. The players said they wanted in Illinois casinos, and when the cops checked with the casinos decided to accuse the players of all sorts of bad things, including computer hacking and various sorts of conspiracy. Let's discuss this in two parts, the casino part and the asset forfeiture part. You were involved in the players versus the Illinois casinos part of this case. So what were the charges? What actually happened? And where does that case stand now? Are those cases stand now?
Okay. So there were five people involved with this. And they were playing a machine that had, I'm not sure what we should legally call it, but kind of a programming glitch. Here's the idea. When they played the machine and switched denominations and numbers of units a couple times, they ended up with a $5 pay table for a $1 game. In other words, they were being paid five times what they should have been when they won. Okay? This is a huge, huge advantage.
Yes.
And the machines were in Illinois and Mississippi only. It was only a particular game. It was a multi-game machine, and this only applied to one particular game. Excuse me. But the five players in total won about $1.2 million, at least according to the best estimates, let's say, of the casinos or claims, whatever.
Okay.
So the five players were charged in Illinois. They're not the only players that played this, but they were the ones that the casinos were able to particularly determine. They were charged with felonies. On the average, about 16 or 17 felonies each, for a total of 82 counts. There were five or six kinds of charges on each of them. Cheating in the general sense, computer fraud, and computer tampering, in that the prosecutors considered these to be computers, and yes, they do have computer chips in them. They are, in the strictest sense, computers. Money laundering, and then structuring as well. And so, total of 82 counts, five people, criminal charges, all felonies, went to trial a couple months ago, and after about 4 days, the judge found them all not guilty of all charges, all criminal charges. And so that one, that is over with. That can't be brought again.
So, Bob, let me ask you this. The police in Arizona call the casino. The casino looks into it. They have to go to a district attorney, right, and say, you should charge these guys, they were cheating. How does the district attorney come up with the computer hacking and some of these other charges? Is he just trying to throw everything he can think of at the wall to see what sticks, or
exactly now, but however, in a way, we've left out a step in that they caught this early enough that they still had most of the surveillance videotape. They analyzed the videotapes. They did close-ups, and they were able to determine exactly what the play was. Okay, this was not quite as simple as, oh, they won $1.2 million, let's charge them as criminals. And so they took the position that playing this pay table was not legal.
The DA took that position.
The gaming board, the casinos, and the prosecutors took that position.
Now,
yep, go ahead.
Are there likely to be the same case in Mississippi?
Yes, and it is very, very likely to be the same outcome. As a matter of fact, they're charged with many fewer counts, and the investigation was not quite as intense. And so, yes, this is likely to end the same way in Mississippi. I'm certainly optimistic.
I'm still trying to make the jump in their mind. So they see a player, and he pushes a bunch of buttons, and the machine malfunctions. How is that the player's fault? I mean,
okay, that's a good question. Let me break it down. First of all, you used the word malfunction. I don't like using that word, certainly in the courtroom, because there, although this isn't written into the law per se, there are an awful lot of both machines and table games, for that matter, that says machine malfunction voids all play. And so I prefer not to use that word. But
good
the point,
point.
Is, in this particular case, it became clear through a pretty intense investigation that the manufacturer, that happened to be Williams, that the programming that caused the 5x2 large pay table was within the code that was sent from the manufacturer. There's a certain step, apparently. I'm not a computer scientist, but there's a certain step where it required an additional step that they didn't take to alter something by the programmers. That step was not taken, and so on this one game, they got this really favorable pay table. Now, the state ultimately took the position that this was an inside job, and by inside job, I mean this. Let's say that a programmer at a manufacturer intentionally programmed something for a huge advantage for players, and then either in partnership with some players or selling this information to some players got the secret way of landing on this particular pay table when they should not have been entitled to it. That would be a crime. That would be a conspiracy among people to defraud the machine, the casino, the manufacturer, whatever.
And this would not be the first time that had happened.
Correct. However, those are not the facts of our case. Williams did, and this was part of the trial, a rather intense investigation in which they interviewed all their programmers. They went to the trouble of getting all of the cell phone numbers of all of their programmers and submitting those, getting the records to the service providers, the phone companies, essentially. And they compared all the calls, all the numbers that were in those phones, to the phone numbers that were used by our five people. They determined no contact, no connection. They also were satisfied themselves, and they are computer scientists, that this was an inadvertent kind of stuff happens incident in which an accidental mistaken programming was made, and they called it that. And so there really was no evidence, in fact, of an inside job. In addition, I can't exactly disclose a few things that aren't a public record, but it was really clear that these were players, advantage players, who happened to see another player, not a person who was charged, playing, and they just were watching the number of credits fly up on these machines. And so that caught their eye, and they watched for a little while, and they were able to determine how this became such a profitable game and, employed the same strategy for themselves. So the prosecutors took the position, okay, inside job, this is cheating. And then as a fallback, they kind of said that, you know, this was never intended to be the game as it was played. And they said, so using this pay table that the players should have known was not the authorized pay table, became criminal. That particular theory didn't go anywhere for the prosecution either, and the judge found everybody not guilty. Part two, you kind of went into, how do they get computer fraud? Well, under the language of the computer fraud statutes, and this would be the case anywhere, this, they don't contemplate gambling for this. Using a computer beyond its authorized intent, or beyond which somebody is authorized. In other words, a hacker is not authorized to go inside a computer, in effect. Okay? And so if a hacker makes money off of a computer by hacking into it, let's just say one went to an ATM and added two zeros to every withdrawal, or at least on the portion of the computer that spits out the money.
One zero is enough.
That would be computer fraud.
Right, but they're not authorized to change the program of the machine, but they are authorized to push any buttons on the machine that they desire in any order that they desire.
And you will be the co-counsel on the next case that I handle in that.
Well, good. You might have to pass the bar first, Richard. Yeah, you might have a little bit.
I already have a margarita. I never pass a bar.
All right, good.
So,
these guys, some of them were driving home to Nevada.
Yeah, one of them.
One of them.
In particular. And, yeah.
And so he had some money with him, and now the cops have it.
Yep.
What's happening there?
Classic horror story to APs. He's driving through Arizona on his way home. He's got $400,000 cash in the trunk. That was $400,000 that he had won from this particular play. He gets pulled over for speeding, or actually following too close, an even more nebulous kind of charge, on an Arizona highway. I'm pretty satisfied that he was not targeted, you know, from Illinois or Mississippi. Stop this car. We think it's got, illegal gambling money or something like that. It's a random traffic stop. And so after the random stop, the police has the driver. He's alone in the car. Get out of the car. Like so many very typical traffic stops, the driver's a little bit nervous. Maybe more than a little bit nervous, because he's got more than the average amount of cash in the trunk. He knows that police do illegal searches sometimes. And so, long story short, they end up searching the trunk off of this following too close charge. And they recover this cash. They also recover a few gambling-related slips. There were a couple W-2Gs that were generated. There was a receipt for a safe deposit box. There were players' cards, and so they talk to the driver. The driver says, "This is all legal money. I won it legally at these casinos," and that leads the Arizona State Police to contact the casinos who are involved. Casinos who were involved have some degree of, hey, these machines were losing, but not entirely, and they go back and they watch the play on the machines, and eventually they figure out how they bled on these machines and lost all this money. So, yes, Arizona has that money, and then Illinois has the money that was in the safe deposit box that I referred to there being a slip for. And so in both states, there are pending forfeiture, civil forfeiture proceedings in which the state is trying to keep that money.
Now, given that all the criminal charges were dropped, does that bode well for getting the money back?
Well, that's one point for the good guys, but it's not game, set, match. Sorry for the mixed metaphor. There are a number of ways that they are trying to keep the money. First of all, now this happened in April, just about 2 years ago. And so because these were not subject to W-2Gs, we can explain that later if we need to, but the point is no deductions were made when this money was earned. So the IRS is interested not from a criminal standpoint, but that's income to the people who earned it, and so they're interested in the taxes on that money, and so they've got a bit of a lien. That part doesn't depend on a crime being committed. Secondly, under our various state forfeiture laws, there's still a battle as to whether or not money that is illegally obtained, money that is illegally obtained is theoretically subject to forfeiture, but there's still a battle over whether or not money that was legally obtained can be subject to forfeiture under some circumstances.
How is that?
Well, prosecutors would say, what if we can come up with a different crime other than the ones that were charged? And prove by a preponderance of the evidence instead of beyond a reasonable doubt that it was illegally obtained. That's one way. Number two, even if it was legally obtained, what if prosecutors claim that this was structured money? And number three, under some money laundering statutes, and every state has their own, but under a large number, they refer to money that was subject to structuring or was subject to a cash reporting requirement that gets transported without ever having that CTR being generated, that is subject to forfeiture. And so that battle continues. From a delay point of view, it's very routine that civil cases such as this get filed but put on hold until the criminal case has been disposed of. The criminal case has now been disposed of, but just 2 months ago, and so they're only gearing up litigating the civil forfeitures.
So let me ask you this, Bob. This was 2013, right?
Yep.
So let's say I earn $400,000 in 2013 in April, in the beginning, the first few months of 2013. In April, they confiscate the money, and now it's time for me to do my taxes at the end of the year. Am I supposed to say I earned $400,000, but it's been stolen from me, so I can't pay tax on it? I mean, how does that work? Are you liable for the tax even though they've taken your money and you don't have it back yet?
That's a really good question, and I don't know the entire answer to that. For one thing, as a practical matter, here's how I might handle it. If it were me, and I wish I had this $400,000, but if it were me, I would get an extension on filing those taxes. I would file something that says this may be income, but it's been seized from me, and I'm going to wait to file until this plays out. I don't have the money. If I never get it back, you know, the IRS might say you won that money and you still owe us taxes on it. Then again, for somebody who, let's just say the person who won all this money doesn't really have any assets, it's kind of a moot question. The IRS is never going to collect anything from them. Mm-hmm. For somebody who does have, let's just say, a house and a savings account to cover the taxes, it becomes much more problematic, I think.
All right, we got lots more questions for you. We're going to change subjects. There's a hole carting case in Illinois that you're involved with, and we understand that there's some things you can't disclose because this is pending litigation. But what can you tell us about this hole carting case in Illinois?
Okay. I'm going to tell you what's public, and I think we can get into it pretty deeply. First, it happens to be at a table game, Mississippi Stud, rather than blackjack, but pretty much the same principles apply as a hole carding game in blackjack. The allegation is that you've got two players at the table. One is the dealer is inadvertently being sloppy and exposing the card that is not exposed at the beginning of the hand, or is exposing one of the three community cards by the manner in which she takes the cards out of the shoe. One of the two players is reading that card and flat betting, and at the same time is signaling to the other player the value of this exposed card. Now, there are hole card games in which a dealer might be exposing it to the whole table. There are hole card games in which the dealer might be exposing the card just at a certain angle to one or two of the seats at the table. This seems to have been a little bit of a combination of that. It wasn't quite that uniform. And so we are dealing with a statute that is present in some form in most, if not all, gambling jurisdictions, and this takes a minute to digest. The wording of the statute is that it is a felony to place a bet after acquiring information that is not available to all players and would affect the outcome of the hand. Now, that wording is ever so slightly different in different states, but the idea is placing a bet after you get information that's not available to all players. Can I take a minute to kind of explain what that's may or may not go to and what's the idea behind it?
Sure. Please. Yeah.
Okay.
Please.
All right. This statute was first passed in the mid-'80s in Nevada and New Jersey, and in those years, those were the only two states with casino gambling. You know, now it's in 30-something, however many, you know, that there are. I have not gotten a definitive answer as to what games that would apply to. And the word available, as it's used in the statute, is not defined. Now, there are a couple things that spring to mind. What kind of wrongdoing is that designed to combat? Well, first of all, there were some point shaving scandals, some sports betting events that were fixed, and it's interesting that we would be discussing that this morning, because for those listeners who have heard the news that Manny Pacquiao didn't disclose that he had a shoulder injury before last weekend's fight, one can imagine that an insider to the Pacquiao camp, let's say, without throwing the fight, might know and gain an advantage from knowing of Pacquiao's pre-existing injury and put a lot of money on Merriweather. And I can see what this statute would apply to that situation, placing a bet after having information not available to all players. So I wonder whether or not the inception of that is, you know, from point-shaving scandals in the 80s. It's a possibility. Next possibility is a live poker ring game. If there are people, let's say you got nine people playing the game, sitting at the table, and two or three of them are in cahoots and sharing in some way the values of their hands, they have an advantage over the other players, and that would be cheating, as would the sports betting example. But I can't find where this law had its inception, what it was designed to combat. Now, there was a hole card play in the 80s. The sheriff of, I think it was Washoe County, versus Einbinder and Dalbin. Maybe it was Clark County. I don't remember. But Mr. Einbinder and Dalbin were playing the exact same kind of game at blackjack. The dealer was inadvertently and obviously exposing the hole card. One of them was the spotter, flat betting a small amount. The other was the big player, who received signals from the spotter as to what the value of that hole card was, or how to play the hand. Either way, that's information that was not available to all players. Now, in blackjack, you place your initial bet before the hand starts, but you do place additional bets. If you have a double down, you got a split, or you're taking insurance. So theoretically, that meets the requirements of the statute. And so Messrs. Einbinder and Dalbin were arrested, charged with felonies in Nevada. The case was dismissed in the trial court, but in a manner that wasn't jeopardy. The case went up to the Nevada Supreme Court, who, in a very short opinion, basically said, this is not cheating. This is the casino's responsibility to protect their own game, in effect. And so hole carding in the mid-'80s was found to not be cheating. It included hole carding with a signal because, you know, there are two times when a player gets information that may not be available to all players under this kind of scenario. The flashing of the dealer's card to a player, that's information that may not be available to others. And then when the spotter signals the big player sitting at the table, that's also information that may not be available to all players, depending on how you interpret the word available.
Do they have the burden of proof to, do they have to prove that that not everyone at the table could see it? I mean, couldn't the players claim the information was available to everyone at the table?
They could maintain that. Now, as the defense attorney, I would respond a couple ways. First of all, that even if the flash is only to one or two spots, I would maintain that the spot is available to all players. Number two, I would maintain as the defense attorney that the word available is not defined, and in lieu of a definition that puts players on notice as to what's illegal, that they can't be found guilty of that crime. And then, you know, arguably, this is why I mentioned that the dealer was somewhat erratic as to the angle of exposing the card. Different hands, it might have been available or not available to different positions at the table. So I maintain that the law is very vague. Now, so Nevada Supreme Court 30 years ago says hole carding is not illegal. It's the casino's responsibility. That's precedent in Nevada. It's not precedent elsewhere. But it ought to be some guidance to somebody.
So why are they pursuing the case?
I am so tempted to give you an editorial comment on
something like the casino is a large donor to the
employees and where their loyalties lie. Best answer I can give you, because they can. This is the same office that overcharged the people on the machine game that we talked about a few minutes ago. And I think that is a huge overreaction. It's also a little bit odd that in this case it seems to have been initiated when one of the players was dealt two aces and the on the same hand the community cards contained two aces, and so they won the equivalent of the jackpot on this game for having a hand with four aces. That caught the casino's attention. And then they looked at tapes and determined that dealer was flashing and the players were getting the whole card. And so they brought criminal charges, trying to claim that this statute covers that kind of conduct. Okay? I brought a preliminary motion asking to declare the statute unconstitutional. Those are, like, never granted, but you bring it anyway just to make a complete record so it can be challenged in an appellate court later if need be. The judge did deny the preliminary motion to hold the statute of unconstitutional, saying we haven't had the trial yet, we don't know exactly what the facts are, and it can be brought again later. So that's where that case stands. We have not gone to trial. It will be a trial, though, apparently.
Huh. And how long ago did the actual – how long ago did this happen?
Just about a year ago. The case has been pending about a year.
Wow.
Yep. And for what it's worth, there's a small forfeiture of about $14,000 attached to that civil forfeiture. So that'll have to play out as well.
Well, that after $400,000 or $1.2 million, $14,000 seems like chicken feed, but it's somebody else's chicken feed and not.
By the way, I wanted to bring up one point about the CTRs.
Yes.
I kind of have made it a habit to have some large cash transactions at my bank. Specifically, so I do generate CTRs so that if this kind of thing happens in the future, I can say, look, I'm not trying to avoid CTRs. You can see that I have them in the past. I'm trying to avoid the casino getting my name. Good idea, bad idea? What do you think of that strategy?
I think it's a superb idea. I'll come back to that in a sec, but I even think that it's a good idea if somebody is playing on a player's card. It's even a good idea to at least once in a while get a CTR from the casino with the same rationale. But if you're playing anonymous, then you need to be avoiding the casino. Now, in that machine game that we talked about, the one with the 82 counts, there was a structuring count, and we defended it in kind of three different ways. One of the ways that we defended it is the very idea that you just mentioned. Hey, I'm not hiding this from the IRS. I don't want to be known to the casino because then they won't let me play this game that I think I can beat. And it's not illegal to hide it if you have that intent. We defended in part on that basis, and when the judge found everybody not guilty on that charge, he got a little bit folksy on us. And he tells how back in the 50s and maybe early 60s, he watched the show Maverick with James Garner. And I remember an episode of Maverick where he was winning kind of big at a poker game, and at a certain point he got up to leave, and a friend of his said, "Why are you leaving? You can take this game for so much more money." And his response was something, "Well, I want to be welcome to come back the next time." And so the judge used that kind of rationale to say you might not want to let the casino know what you're doing. That's not illegal. So I totally agree with that. Now, there it gets murkier.
If it's good enough
however.
For Maverick, it's good enough for us.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Now, we're talking, unfortunately,
gets murkier, however.
Unfortunately,
imagine a case where
Mr.
somebody
Loeb,
has a reason to hide it from the IRS and somebody has a reason to hide it from the casino.
Bob,
in other words, you have both intents.
Bob, I'm sorry. We're running out of time, and Bob needs to go to commercials here.
Sure.
But we actually have quite a few more things to talk about. Be prepared for an email within the next 3 hours from Richard asking you when you can come back onto the show again. It has been very informative and very interesting, and we very much appreciate you taking your time today.
Well, I appreciate the comments, and I'll brace myself for that email. I look forward to coming back.
Okay,
good.
Thanks.
Good. That's the right answer.
Good.
All right. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. On Mondays through Thursdays in May, you can earn free buffets. Play 300 points before 1 p.m. and get a free lunch buffet. Pay 600 points before 8 p.m. and earn a free dinner buffet. You can earn both lunch and dinner buffets in the same day for 600 points total, so long as at least the first 300 points are earned before 1 p.m. You do not need to eat the buffets on the same day that you earn them, but they're redeemable Monday through Thursday, and they expire. I haven't actually seen the thing. They usually expire a few days into the next month. So getting a whole backlog of 30 buffets doesn't make any sense unless you have a lot of friends coming to town. They're double point days on two separate days this month, Mother's Day, which is this coming Sunday, May 10th, and Memorial Day, which is Monday, May 25th. All video poker machines, no limits, no restrictions. This month, the South Point is giving extra free play away on the weekends if they have your email address. They do this once or twice a year. This is a way to bribe you into giving them your email address. How much you get depends on what level your mailer is. For the players who get the $75 per week mailer, on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, if they play an additional $750 coin in, they get $150 of free play. So that's a 2% bonus on games where basically they're even games off the top. And if you live locally, a 2% bonus is well worth the trip to go in. At the Palms, the weekly 7 p.m. drawings on Friday. Each week, winners share $3,000. Excuse me, winners share $10,000 with a top prize of $3,000. You don't need to be there, but you do need to claim it by midnight. They have multiple drawing entries earlier on the Friday beforehand, and also afterwards. PFP, play for prizes, through May 15th will be Walgreens gift cards. For the two subsequent weeks, you'll be eligible for Fresh and Easy gift cards. Fresh and Easy is a kind of like a fast food supermarket here in the Vegas area. I don't know if they're elsewhere in the country. Gift cards may be earned and redeemed Monday through Friday at a rate of 0.2%. You keep your points. At videopoker.com, this is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold Membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on many of the games. It's a good place to practice Quick Quads, for example, which in my opinion is the best game to play on double point days. You can get the strategy from me or the Wizard of Oz website, but if you want correction, go to videopoker.com. For most players, you have no idea of how bad you really play until you have a computer program correcting your errors. The game of the week is Wheel Poker with Quick Quads. This is a 7 coins per line game where you get to spin a virtual wheel every time you get a quad, 4 of a kind, or a quick quad. The wheel ranges in value from 50 to 2,000. It's random, but the spaces are not equally weighted. You definitely need to figure out a different strategy for this game. You need to add the average amount of the spin onto the quad values in order to get the appropriate strategy. All right. Richard, next week our guest is Ed Miller. He has a new book out.
He has a new book called The Course. It's really an excellent book for someone who wants to jump into No Limit Hold'em and make money at it very quickly, I think. So, you know, a lot of blackjack players often are looking at, should I take up poker? You know, they get burned out on blackjack. They get tired of getting thrown out of all the casinos. They think about taking up poker. I think, you know, this is a book that very quickly you can go into 1-2 and 2-5 No Limit Hold'em and start making money pretty quickly. Not a lot of money, but, you know.
Well, one of the subtitles is it's I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's No Limit Hold'em for Smart Players. In other words, this is geared for you got to have something on the ball to follow this strategy.
That's true. But I suppose that anyone who has been able to beat video poker or blackjack by counting cards would have what it takes to, you know, to beat these low-limit games.
Yes. I found it very interesting. I currently do not have the skills to beat the low-limit games, but I have read the...
But you haven't gone out and tried yet either. I mean, if you've read the book...
I haven't tried recently. Back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, I tried in Gardena, which is a suburb of Los Angeles, and they had poker rooms, and I discovered I was not very good at poker. But that was draw poker. That was a different game.
Yeah.
All right.
And those games were not very honest either, so.
Yeah, well, good. All right, so we got about a minute left, Richard. How do people find out about our radio shows?
Right. We welcome your questions. You can send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge, or you can tweet them to me at RWM21. If you want the show delivered to you every week while you sleep, you can sign up at iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or at my site, richardmunchkin.com. You can find an archive of all the past shows at bobdancer.com. So, yeah, we'd love to hear from you. So send us your suggestions. And if somebody knows somebody who's making a lot of money at Daily Fantasy Sports, I'm still trying to get one of those guys to come on the air. So far, nobody's willing to talk about it.
Yeah, that would be good. So we actually have had some people suggest people so far.
And every time I contact them, they're like, no, I'm making too much money. I don't want to talk about it.
Very good. So that's easily understood. But sometimes somebody will want to talk about it. So thank you very much, Professor Loeb, Richard, and go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.